This evening, I want to talk to you about a point that you already know, but I want to reemphasize it to you. And I want to tell you about a particular style of writing in the New Testament, especially in the Gospels, that brings out this point. And so what we're going to talk about this evening is the point of the greatness of Jesus. You already know how great Jesus is. We're going to reemphasize it to you. But the style of writing that brings this out is what we call echoes of the Bible, or is often referred to as echoes of the Bible. And so we're going to look at the echoes of Elijah and Elisha in the life of Jesus. And I'll explain all of that, what it means. But it's a very subtle way of connecting Jesus back to the Old Testament, back to these powerful prophets, Elijah and Elisha, to make a comparison and to make some important points. And I really believe that this style of writing would come across to an ancient Jew a lot clearer than it does for us. It would take us a lot more work. And so I'm going to bring out some of that. I don't expect you to be experts in this, but hopefully you'll appreciate this particular style of writing. And so, as we look at God's Word, it's amazing. We wouldn't think of this, but surprisingly, the Bible is filled, especially the New Testament, with attempts to convince others of the greatness of Jesus, the superiority of Jesus. Most of this is done in the context of trying to convince Jews who believe that the law and Moses and all of that are the greatest. And so they have to be convinced that Jesus is greater. Jesus is superior. And the Bible does that in a number of ways. Jesus himself told the multitudes, as he was face to face with them, that in front of them is something greater. And in Matthew chapter 12, verse 6, he says, there's something greater than the temple. Now, we understand that, but to the Jew, the temple was something that meant everything to them. It was God's house. It was this beautiful building. They put all their faith and trust in it, unfortunately. And in a way, God says, listen, you can destroy the temple and it won't be rebuilt. And it wasn't the second time around. You can destroy Jesus Christ, and I will bring him back, and he will live forever. There's kind of this greatness comparison of the temple. Put your faith in Jesus, not in the temple. The Jews had a difficult time with that. Jesus then said in Matthew 12:41, a little further down in that chapter, that something greater than Jonah is here. And of course, he was referring to himself. Jonah survived 3 days in the great fish. Jesus was going to use that as the symbol of surviving 3 days in the tomb and then being resurrected. Jesus is greater than Jonah. And then he says in the very next verse, something greater is in front of you than Solomon. And Solomon was seen as not only the wise king, but the richest king. And Jesus is going to bring out riches and wealth and glory in a spiritual sense greater than that of Solomon. So even Jesus, as he was speaking to the multitudes, had to and felt compelled to talk about that he's greater than these things. Paul, 2 Corinthians 3:11, had to convince the Corinthians that Jesus came with more glory. But when you think about this idea of trying to convince others of the greatness of Jesus, what's the book that you probably think of first and foremost? It's what? It's the book of Hebrews, where Jesus is compared to so many things of the Old Testament. He is compared to Moses. He is compared to Joshua. He is compared to the Levitical priest. And it's all with this clear connection that Jesus is better. But one of the interesting things is that the Hebrew author doesn't use a comparison of Jesus with Elijah or Elisha. And I don't know why that is. It might be because he recognized this was already done by the gospel writers. And that the Jews that were familiar with the New Testament would be well aware of that. But we're going to make this comparison that the Hebrew author does it, that the gospel writers do, in a writing style call, or what we call the echoes of the Bible. What is the echo of the Bible? Now, when we talk about Elijah and connecting Elijah to the New Testament, there is a very clear connection in the Bible, New Testament, with Elijah to John the Baptist. That clear connection comes because of Malachi chapter 4, the very last words of the Old Testament. Malachi chapter 4, and in verse 5 and 6, where Jesus says, "Behold, I'm going to send Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and the terrible day of the Lord. And he will restore the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children of the fathers, so that I will not come and smite the land with the curse." And there the Old Testament closes. 2 Kings chapter 2:11 tells us that Elijah departs this world as only the second man, next to Enoch, to forego the whole death process, as he is taken up into heaven in a whirlwind. And so you put those two things together, and there's this expectation in the New Testament that Elijah is coming back. And you definitely see that in the Gospels. Well, Jesus makes a very clear connection, Matthew 11, verse 14, Matthew 17, 11 through 12, that Malachi 4 was talking about John the Baptist. That John the Baptist is Elijah returned. That John the Baptist is the one that made things straight that were crooked. That he restored the relationship from the Father to the sons of the Father. Jesus says that very, very clearly. And so there are some clear connections. But what we're going to talk about is a more subtle connection. You probably have heard of shadows. We've talked about shadows or types before. It's a great study. Shadows tend to be subtle connections, but there's more to it. There's more details. It's a much clearer connection, even though, like Jesus, the connection isn't being made clearly. Matthew 11, Jesus says, John is Elijah. Well, like Genesis chapter 22, where you have Abraham sacrificing Isaac. Well, everyone sees in that a shadow of the death of Jesus. And yet, even in that, there's a greater one, because Abraham doesn't kill Isaac, where God the Father does kill Jesus. And so that's a shadow. An echo is even more subtle than perhaps a shadow is. And so there are these subtle connections from Elijah and Elisha to Jesus, and this is what we call echoes of the Bible. Now, is there an illustration we can use to kind of make this clearer? Well, I don't know how many of you are fans of the Seinfeld TV show, but Seinfeld writers did something like this quite often. They had these episodes where they didn't say they're about this event or about this happening, but there's so much in there, you say, oh, I know what they're doing. And it was a really fun way of recreating history. For example, one of the most famous episodes is where they recreate the movie, the event JFK, the JFK shooting. And this whole thing, instead of a shooter, it's a spitter. And there must have been a second spitter in the grassy knoll and so forth. And they don't ever talk about JFK, but it's clear that through this story, they're making that connection. They're going back to this echo of the JFK movie. They did the same thing with the Olympic athlete Nancy Kerrigan and the woman that kept her out of competition. And so, if you're familiar with that, that's kind of what we're talking about. These echoes of the Bible. So one might say, well, why are we doing this? Well, one, I want you to simply know that there is this writing style in the Bible. I want you to see, at least from this standpoint, what we're bringing out, to recognize this very unique but a very common way of writing back in those days. But I also want you to see that this is just one of the many ways that the Bible goes to bring out that Jesus is better, Jesus is greater, Jesus is superior. And of course, we know that that's an understatement because the idea is that Jesus is the greatest. Jesus is the best. And so I want to ask you, this is the point I want you to take home with you. This is the question I want you to ask. Do you need to be convinced of that? You say, well, no, I am already convinced of that. And I know that. But it's a good question for us because it would be a horrendous mistake. A horrendous mistake if at any point in our life we just let anything become more important than Jesus. In Matthew 16, verse 26, for what will a man be profit if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? There is nothing more important than Jesus. Is that true of our lives? Is that true in your life? Is that the way you live? Is Jesus greater than alcohol? Is Jesus greater than money? Is Jesus greater than a particular friendship? Is Jesus greater than some activity in the world that is considered to be exciting and great? You see, there are things where Satan tries to lure us into those things and say, well, let's go ahead and we'll put Jesus off for a little bit and we'll put these things on. And they will be of no profit. We've got to live a life that is convinced that Jesus is the greatest thing, and that's the way we live our life every day. And so it's a little reminder. It's just a reminder question for us to look at our life to make sure that we are living that Jesus is the greatest. There's nothing more important. And let's make sure of that. So let's start in Luke chapter 4 where Jesus makes the connection of himself to Elijah and Elisha. Luke chapter 4, and we're going to use in this first part Luke. There's so much in this, I'm going to turn this into at least two lessons. But I want to focus on Luke tonight. Luke chapter 4, verse 14. What do we have? We have Jesus starting his ministry early on, and he goes back home, right? And how many of us have been gone from home, and we go back, and we want it to be just like it was? But it never is, right? You just can't go back home. And it's the same with Jesus. Jesus goes back home to Nazareth, and he is met with people that know him, but they don't really. They think they know him. And so they don't believe in him. And in fact, as Jesus points out, they're wanting him to prove himself in a very, very challenging way, in a very unfaithful way. And so in Luke chapter 4, we know that he comes home to Nazareth through his own people. The Messiah has come home, and he goes to the synagogue, and he reads from the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah 61, verse 1, but he cuts off in mid-verse from our Bibles. And so verse 18, here's what he reads. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. So Isaiah's talking about himself. He's talking about someone that's going to do these things, these great things. And verse 20, he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down, and the eyes of all of them in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Jesus basically says, I just did what that passage said was going to happen. It's happened now. I fulfilled it. And they were all at this time speaking well of him and wondering at his gracious words which were falling from his lips. But here's the problem, verse 22. And they were saying, is this not Joseph's son? Wait a second, this is Joseph's son. There can't be anything extraordinary about him. And Jesus picks up on that and knows verse 23. He said to them, "No doubt you will quote this proverb to me, 'Physician, heal yourself.' Whatever we heard was done in Capernaum, well, we'll do it here in your hometown as well." And he said, "Truly, I say to you, no prophet is welcome in his hometown." And that's exactly going to be the problem. They were speaking well of him, but they really weren't. They were wondering about him, but they really had him pegged. And so Jesus comes home, and he doesn't come home to a hero's welcome. He doesn't come home so that everyone will think nice of him. He comes home because Nazareth has a challenge and has a problem. And to bring out this visual for the people of where they stand with him and where they stand with God, look at what he does in verse 25. "But I say to you," and notice the words, "in truth. I say to you in truth that there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the sky was shut up for 3 years and 6 months, when a great famine came over all the land. And yet Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow." So Jesus brings out this connection of Elijah. He tells the story that is told back in 1 Kings chapter 17. Hold your place in chapter 4 of Luke, go back to 1 Kings chapter 17, and you remember that this is a story where there's this famine. God is punishing the people of Israel because they are rejecting him. They are breaking covenant with him. They are not accepting his prophet. Well, Elijah has to live in that land as well. And God takes care of him, gives him food and drink. But that eventually runs out. And so of all the places that God sends him to find a faithful widow who will follow his instructions, he does not go to any of the women or the widows of Israel. He goes all the way to the land of Sidon, to a Gentile land, to a Gentile woman who happens to be a widow. And this is what he finds. You remember the story. Chapter 17, 1 Kings 17, and verse 11, he comes up to the widow as she was going to get out. And he called to her and he said, "Please bring me a piece of bread in your hand." But she said, "Alas, Lord God, as the Lord God lives, I have no bread, only a handful of flour in the bowl, a little oil in the jar, and behold, I'm gathering a few sticks that I may go and prepare for me my son and my son, that we may eat it and die." And Elijah says to her, "Do not fear, go and do as you have said, but first make me a little bread cake and bring it to me, and afterward, then you may make one for yourself and for your son." Imagine you are this widow, and what are you doing? If I can put it this way, you are preparing your last supper. And here comes this Israelite into your land, into your home, and says, "Great, go do it, but give me the first bite. Give me the first food." And she tells him, "Listen, it's not going to be enough." And he says to her, "If you will do this, if you will trust me," verse 14, "the bowl of flour shall not be exhausted, nor shall the jar of oil be emptied, until the day that the Lord sends rain on the face of the earth." And so she does it. And so Elijah has food, she has food, her son has food. And what she hears in this is that God is going to, because of your faith, because of your trust, is going to keep this supply of food. He's going to keep you alive until this famine's over. And so Jesus uses this story to say, "I'm just like Elijah. You are treating me just like Elijah. I have come to my own people." Remember what John put in his gospel in the first chapter? Jesus came to his own, but they did not believe in him. And he says, you are just like Israel in the days of Elijah. And they know what he's saying. And they don't like it. Well, Jesus then, go back, keep your place in 1 Kings 17. We're going to come back to Luke chapter 4 and in verse 27. He tells us a second story, this one connecting himself to Elisha, making the same point. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. And look at their reaction. All the people in the synagogue were filled with rage as they heard these things. And so, think about this story with Elisha. All of these lepers, you've got this man of God, and only one is healed because only one comes to him. He's a Syrian. He's a Gentile. And we know the story of Naaman. He fought at first, and eventually he became obedient. But here's the point Jesus is making. You are just like the people in the days of Elisha. Here's the man of God. Here's the Messiah. And you're not going to be cleansed. I've got to go to other people. People who are not of the covenant. People who are not of my people who will be cleansed. You might remember another gospel account. It tells us that Jesus was able to perform very few miracles in Nazareth. And it wasn't because Jesus had limited power. It's because just the story, why weren't these lepers healed? Because the lepers of Israel did not come to Elisha. The people of Nazareth are not coming to Jesus with their sick and their lame and their poor. They simply don't believe in him. And so Jesus is making these connections to say, I'm just like Elijah and Elisha. You're treating me just the same. And Luke is using this story to draw in the audience to say, here's the comparison. Now, Elisha has a very similar story to this one that he brings out. Elisha has a story with a woman of a bottomless jar of oil that never runs out. A same comparison. And then we also have a story where Elisha resurrects the woman's son in 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 34. Same chapter, story. Now you're like, wait a second, what are you talking about? Elisha resurrects a woman. Well, go back to 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings chapter 17, we have the story of the flour that doesn't run out. The jar of oil is not exhausted. The woman believes God's going to keep her and her son alive during this famine. But look what happens now, the second part of the story, verse 17. And it came about after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became sick. And the sickness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. In other words, he died. Look at the woman's reaction, the widow's reaction. So she said to Elijah, what do I have to do with you, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my iniquity to remembrance and to put my son to death. You saved his life and now you're taking it away. What's going on here? And he said to her, give me your son. And look at how Elijah brings this miracle about. And he took him from her bosom, and he carried him up to the upper room where he was living. And he laid him on his bed. He called to the Lord and said, O Lord my God, have you also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die? And he stretched himself upon the child three times and called to the Lord and said, O Lord my God, I pray you, let this child's life return to him. And the Lord heard the voice of Elijah. And the life of the child returned to him and revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper room into the house and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son is alive." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." So you have the story of the widow and the jar of oil, a story that Jesus makes the connection to. But going back to Luke, where's the story of Jesus and the widow? Well, Luke comes to that in chapter 7. Go over to chapter 7, verse 11. Now, again, I call this an echo because Luke doesn't say, "Hey, I'm making a connection here." But look at Luke chapter 7 and verse 11. "Soon afterwards, Jesus went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large crowd. And now, as he approached the gate of the city, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother." The only son of his mother. Are you getting that? The only son of his mother. "And she was a widow." She was a widow. Are you getting it? "And a sizable crowd from the city was with her. When the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her. And he said to her, 'Do not weep.' And he came up and he touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. And he said, 'Young man, I say to you, arise.' And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother, and fear gripped them all. And they began glorifying God, saying, 'A great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people.' And this report concerning him went all over Judea and all the surrounding districts." So here Jesus comes into the city of Nain, and Jesus resurrects the widow's son. Now again, I think an ancient Jew hearing this or reading this would be like, "Hey, I've heard this before. Hey, this is deja vu. This is very similar to a story I heard with Elijah." Now Luke doesn't say, "Hey, I'm trying to make this connection." But I really believe that Luke is using this as an echo of that story that Jesus brought up in Luke chapter 4. Of the widow and Elijah. In other words, this is the second part of that story. A story that not only Elijah raises a widow's son, but Elisha also raises the son, not of a widow, that's the only difference, of a woman who was promised a son. And so there's this echo here. Now, am I just making this up? Well, take a look, if you would, at some of these details. Not only do we have a widow's son being raised, but in 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 23, Elijah took the child, brought him down to the from the upper room to the house, and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son is alive." Notice I have underlined, you go to Luke chapter 7, verse 15, "The dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother." The exact same words Luke uses from the Old Testament. And not only that, but you have in Luke chapter 7, or 1 Kings 17, verse 24, the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." Well, compare that to Luke 7, 16. "And fear gripped them all, and they began glorifying God, saying, 'A great prophet has risen among us. And God has visited his people.'" Not exact word for word, but the same idea. A great prophet. You are a man of God. God has visited us. The word in your mouth, the word of the Lord in your mouth, is truth. And as you look at that, it's not a direct connection, but it's a subtle connection where a reader would say, "I've heard this story before." And that's exactly what Luke wants the reader to do. And so, Luke is using this to connect a connection that he's made with Jesus back in Luke chapter 4. But he's also using this story not only to say, hey, Jesus is like Elijah and Elisha, but he's actually using this story to say, in the likeness, there's actually a difference, a very big difference, and that is that Jesus, as powerful as those prophets are, as much as he is alike them, he is different in that he is greater. He is superior. And one of the ways you see that come out is just look at the miracle itself. Let me ask you, what did Elijah have to do to raise up this child? Well, he had to take the child from his mother. He went up to the upper room, he put him on his bed, and he stretches himself out on the child three times. I think there is some echoes there as you see a stretching out in death and a bringing back to life. So he stretches himself on this child three times, and then he has to pray to God. And when you read that story, as we did, even though it's Elijah doing the miracle, the whole emphasis is on God. God is the one that raised the child. Elijah was able to do it because he called on God. He prayed to God. Now compare that to Jesus. What about Jesus? Jesus what? All he has to do is touch the coffin and tell the son to arise. And he does. A greater miracle. The emphasis here is God did it, not Elijah. The emphasis here is that Jesus did it. He didn't have to call on God. He didn't have to pray to God. And that's the point. He is greater because what? We are still emphasizing God did this miracle, and it's Jesus. Do you see that? And so Luke is using these echoes to make this comparison, but the true comparison he wants is that Jesus is greater. He's a greater miracle worker. Jesus is God. God in the flesh. Now, real quickly, what comes up next in this story after the raising of the widow's son? Look at verse 18. Luke 7, verse 18, right after this miracle, Luke decides to tell us this. The disciples of John reported to him about all these things. Summoning to his disciples, John sent them to the Lord, saying, are you the expected one, or do we look for someone else? John decides, hey, now that we've made this echo comparison, now let me tell you, here's some that had this question, is Jesus the one? Is he the great one? Is he the one we're looking for? Or are we waiting for someone else? And look at what Jesus' answer is. At verse 21, at that very time, Jesus cured many people of diseases and afflictions and evil spirits, and he gave sight to many who were blind. And he answered and said to them, go report to John what you have seen and what you have heard. Here's what you've seen, here's what you heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed. The lepers are cleansed, Naaman. The lepers are, the deaf hear, the dead are raised. The poor have the gospel preached to them. Blessed is he who does not take offense at me. And so in answer to them, Jesus what? He does miracles. He says, look at the miracles. Tell John about the miracles. Some of the very miracles that Elijah and Elisha did. But what?
Even more so.
And when you think about the story of Elijah and Elisha, you know, if you think that, oh, there's miracles throughout the Old Testament from Genesis to Malachi, they're just all over the... No. There's periods of time where there's miracles. And then there's periods of time, there's no miracles. And before Elijah and Elisha, there's a long period where there are prophets and they're coming and they're preaching the word of God and they're warning the people, but there's no miracles. And all of a sudden, here comes Elijah.
And he's got this power to do these miracles and to heal people and to even raise the dead. And then after him, the man that was asked for a double portion of spirits, able to do the same things. These great miracles. And that's part of the comparison. They did these great miracles. In a way, Elijah, Elisha, no one did more miracles in the Old Testament than them. But in the New Testament, Jesus is a better miracle worker. in the type of miracle, in the way he performs the miracle, in the sheer volume of miracles. And that's what a Jew would read into this. This is what Luke is trying to subtly bring out in this story. And so we're going to talk a little bit more. We'll look at a few more shadows next week, or a few more echoes next week. But when you see these, and they're not the easiest thing to see, but when someone can bring them out to you, it's powerful to see what the writers are doing, that Jesus is greater. Because Elijah and Elisha are probably the two most powerful miracle-working prophets in the Bible. And yet Jesus is so much superior, greater than them. So as we close tonight, using this same story, we have the arrival of Elijah and Elisha in the days of King Ahab. And I think it's significant to look at it this way. King Ahab is introduced in 1 Kings 16, 30 and 31 this way. Here's his resume. And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. You got the worst, the most evil, the most vile king to have ever come. He's now on the throne. It hasn't gotten any worse than now. Now, as bad as that is, you've got to add to the mixing bowl Jezebel. Now you add Jezebel to the mix, and what do you got? You've got Israel under the leadership of the two most evil, vilest leaders they've ever known, and probably will ever know. And the people of Israel are suffering. God tells Elijah, "You're not alone. I have 7,000 people who have not come to the evilness of Ahab and Jezebel, but they're suffering. They're praying out to God." And so what was God's response when Satan brings his most evil, powerful leaders, Ahab and Jezebel? God's response is, "I'll bring Elijah and Elisha." All of a sudden, we've got prophets that can do miracles. We didn't read about that before. All of a sudden, they can resurrect the dead. And what you and I need to understand is, as we look at this world and we look at abortion and we can't believe what's going on with that, and homosexuality and all of the evil and the leaders that, and what they want to do with religion and the freedom of religion, and we're like, where's this world going to? I want you to know God has a response. And today his response is a better response than even Elijah and Elisha. It's Jesus Christ. And if he's not the greatest thing in your life, then you're not ready to overcome the evil that this world is unleashing. If we can help you tonight make Jesus the greatest thing in your life through your obedience to him, won't you let that be known as together we stand. And as we sing.